First You Think is a not-for-profit ministry of the First Unitarian Church of Des Moines. Support us at ucdsm.org today.
Good morning. My name is Louise Alcorn. I am a member here at First Unitarian. I'm happy to be addressed as she, her, hers, or hey, Wheezy. I did a version of this service twice back in 2004. Some of you long-timers may remember that I was famously interrupted by folk singer the first time I did this service. It's a great story. Buy me a beer. I rewrote this service in 2020 in the midst of real fears, well, mostly real, of a global pandemic. But I kept it pretty light. And I shared with you how I coped and still cope with both everyday and existential fear. There was a lot about birds. It was pretty good. In both services, I focused on identifying rational versus irrational fears, how they lead to angry behavior and poor decisions. I leant heavily on readings like the ones you heard earlier from the AA and Al-Anon programs, because there's some really useful stuff in there. I recommend it. I joked at each service that one day I wanted to do a talk entitled A Culture of Fear or Why the World Needs a 12-Step Program. Well, folks, this is that service. With apologies, there will be fewer bird jokes. In fact, I have to say, as I was revising this up till yesterday afternoon, it got less and less funny. I know the title says, I promise it will be funny. But as the winds tear through and life is frankly getting a little awful, it was hard. There still will be humor, I promise. So the title, The Culture of Fear, came from a book of the same name that I discovered before my first service. So it's by Barry Glassner, a sociology professor, and it unpacks the problem of misinformation in our society, specifically why we are afraid and how we are made afraid of all the wrong things, while ignoring actual reality-based challenges like poverty and racism. Here's the thing. He wrote the book in the late 90s, pre-9/11, pre-Twin Towers, post-Timothy McVeigh, but pre-pandemic. I read it first in 2003 and realized even then that 9/11 and the subsequent decades-long wars on terrorism had simply calcified the problem of bad data hyped by bad actors, which he'd described. It was very prescient. His chapter on metaphoric illnesses, in which, among other scares, he recounted anti-vaccine efforts in the 80s, the 80s, based in bad science and media misinformation, which was only more prescient in 2020 as I was rewriting, especially as I watched the president tell us to swallow bleach. Sorry, my nose is running. I apologize. I blame the wind. So then his chapter titled Black Men begins, journalists, politicians, and other opinion leaders foster fears about particular groups of people, both by what they play up and what they play down. He discusses the public perception of race and crime, contrasted with the verifiable data about who are the actual victims of crime. Again, this is 20 years ago. Later, I listened to our own Harvey Harrison expand my understanding of the inequalities of our justice system and the problem of mass incarceration, which Glassner had shown was being distorted by the media. So as I rewrote my service in 2020, Black Lives Matter was perhaps finally forcing us to focus on the real effects of our deeply racist society on people of color, both on their lived experience, but also on our societal perceptions of that experience, which have always been badly, deliberately skewed. So dated as it is now, I keep going back to the book's basic premise that it's so easy and often profitable to make people afraid of something fake or distorted, and that this distortion keeps us from facing what is genuinely wrong. Now, this distortion may be the result of simple greed to sell media or ideology, but it may also be the result of the natural human tendency to point and scream at overblown problem B, because we just can't talk about actual problem A. For example, you may obsess about the cost of gas and count every mile in penny. That's real. But when your real worry, the one you cannot utter, is that you'll lose your job. But it's easier to think about the cost of gas. We may look with disdain at, say, anti-vaxxers who base their arguments on false anecdotes from celebrities, and we declare they just don't understand science, which may be true, but we should be cautious and ask ourselves, what deep-seated fear is being expressed here? Is it actual distrust of medical science, or a more generalized, unarticulated fear that we cannot protect our children, that if they get sick, we need someone to blame? Their fear is misdirected, but it's there, and dismissing it doesn't help the dialogue. So distortion of reality is also at the very root of addiction and addictive personalities. This is where the 12 steps comes in. For anyone who has lived with an addict or a narcissist, you know that their greatest power is creating their own reality and making others live in it. Again, I point to Mr. Bleach. 4 years of addictive behavior. Think about it. The Al-Anon and AA readings that Barb shared earlier, although these describe how an addictive brain works, also nicely describe cultural reactions on a larger scale. So all humans on some level make decisions based in part on fear. This is perfectly natural. Fear of what we do not understand, and increasingly in modern society, fear that we are losing something. Something specific or non-specific, the American way, whatever the hell that is. But we know that it's just slipping away, even if we cannot articulate it. Especially if we cannot articulate it. This fear is fed, watered, and fertilized by the remarkable echo chamber of social media. So humans are tribal, right? And if the tribe tells us to be afraid of something, we are inclined to believe it. But what if, as Barb's reading described, our tribe is living upon a basis of unsatisfied demands in a state of continual disturbance and frustration? So is the tribe distorting reality? And what should we believe? So before my last service, I spent a couple of evenings watching primetime television, and I really watched those commercials. You're welcome. It was terrible. And I kept a particularly critical eye on the fear messages. I'm so glad I have streaming now. I can't stand commercials. Anyways, in one evening of primetime viewing, I was encouraged to fear going bald. My digestion, too much acid, too little fiber. My hair, is it brittle? Does it shine? My car's tires, this was big. My car's tires, are they good enough? Will I skid and kill someone? Will they carry my children safely? I don't even have children. Bad breath, body odor. Being fat, that came up no less than 4 times. And last, but by no means least, I should fear for the safety of my home from burglars, carbon monoxide, and termites. It made me want to run screaming into the street where I might have been hit by a car with bald tires. You're welcome. Seriously, it was a terrible evening. All right. Glasner writes, one of the paradoxes of a culture of fear is that serious problems remain widely ignored, even though they give rise to precisely the dangers that the populace most abhors. So poverty, for example, correlates strongly to child abuse, crime, and drug abuse. Income inequality is also associated with adverse outcomes for society as a whole, and some argue political stability in a nation, especially one where we think ourselves not as haves and have-nots, but as haves and will-haves, which is America. I was an American Studies major in college, so the phrase from 12 Step about "we eat, drink, and grab for more of everything we need, fearing we shall never have enough," has always struck me as particularly American. Every time I listen to NPR's Marketplace and they say, "we're worried that people aren't buying enough stuff because it's going to ruin our economy," makes me shudder. I'm not implying that advertisers and politicians invented fear as a motivator. They simply harness and exploit it for their own purposes. Again, perfectly natural, perfectly human. So if one can have a favorite economist, right? Mine is Robert Reich. Okay, he's the one-time Secretary of Labor from the Clinton administration who resigned in some frustration, frankly, when no one listened to his reality-based arguments about poverty and inequality. If you haven't watched Reich's engaging inequality media videos on YouTube, I strongly recommend them. So although his focus is usually the economy, explained super clearly with cool infographics and cartoons, really, strong recommend. A recent commentary that he did reflected a familiar distortion that has sadly come around again. He says, "Let me remind you, bigotry against minority groups based on sexual orientation or gender identity, such as the trans community, is a way fascism takes root. As the world tragically witnessed in Europe in the 20s and 30s, the politics of sexual anxiety gains traction when traditional male gender roles of family provider and protector are hit by economic insecurity. Fascist politics distorts and expands this male anxiety into fear that one's family is under existential threat from LGBTQ plus people who reject the family's traditional structure and traditions. That narrative is back." Many of you know that I'm a public librarian. I am your friendly neighborhood librarian. In a way that we haven't dealt with since the McCarthy era, my profession is under siege from so-called Moms for Liberty. Have you encountered them? Who would have you believe, who would have you fear that my job is to force alternative lifestyles on your children. I don't have that kind of time. The reality, queer-focused stories and queer romances are flying off our shelves because people want to read them. We can't keep them in stock. They have long hold lists, mostly made up of straight, cis, white people, because story is where we safely explore that which is outside our lived experience. It's a way that we face fear or curiosity or just read a really good romance. There has been some good research about the kind of people who join cults, extremist militia groups, incel and anti-Semite chat rooms, scary places, but also milder but equally pernicious affinity groups based in falsehood and isms. So these adherents may or may not believe all or even most of what is being spouted. But that tribal sense of belonging, of being understood, is all powerful. So they tell us, "yes, we are afraid of the same things you are, and we're going to tell you who to blame." It's so powerful. This is entirely human. And again, to bring it back to the 12 step, it's a classic addict's way of looking at the world. Ask many alcoholics about their destructive behaviors, and they are likely to give you a list of who is to blame. That list may even be real: abusive parents, an oppressive society. But the behaviors are based in fear. Fear of change, fear of being revealed. I would argue it's similar with these affinity groups, so your Moms for Liberty and so forth. Making you afraid of fake problem B, like trans kids or scary books, means that you don't have to acknowledge your part in real problem A, whatever that might be. Poverty, income inequality, difference, othering. So for some years, I have had a theory, this I believe, if you will. It's heavily influenced by 12-step programs, as in the readings that Barb gave. The theory goes something like this, that any decisions we make as individuals, as families, as communities, or as nations, I like to think big, that any decisions we make that are based primarily on fear or on fear's playmates, anger and hatred, these decisions never turn out well. They're not healthy, and they don't have healthy outcomes. Whatever short-term benefits we might imagine, they are rarely lasting or ultimately conducive to personal or corporate growth and happiness. That's me thinking big since the early noughts. So, we do live in a culture of fear. Fear is a great motivator and also a great manipulator. These messages aren't just in families with addiction. So, if we are told over and over again that going into the city will get us killed, what are the chances we'll go downtown to see a show? What effect will this ultimately have on that city's urban life and the prevalence of white flight? More broadly, if we're convinced, told even, that a group of people mean us harm, what are the chances that we'll reach out to them? And what will this reticence do to our relations with our neighbors? That fear is playing out everywhere right now. As the world becomes increasingly uncertain, as the winds blow hard, except, of course, they just stopped blowing. Whatever. It was a great line. Anyhow, as the world becomes uncertain, a perfectly human, fear-based reaction is to worry about what this means for my life, for my comfort and security. We all do this. This is simply human. But we need to step past that fear and ask the right questions. Collectively, we need to acknowledge the culture of fear that exists for others because of the status quo that might be comfortable for us. We have to overcome our fears, our loss of security, of change, even of rejection. So the fourth step of AA asks us to take a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Again, I think this can be applied collectively, not just individually. So I know we've had enough anger recently to last a lifetime. It's become our national dialogue, just sort of being pissy at each other. Very annoying. But anger is so often an extension and expression of fear, of being afraid of something. And again, sometimes it's an unarticulated something. It's so easy to make a soundbite out of blaming. And because we all live with these emotions, again, perfectly natural, it feels like truth, even when it's not. So the 10th step tells us to continue to take this personal inventory, and when we are wrong, promptly admit it. So I think there's a question that we need to include in the national dialogue. Are we as a nation, as a people, acting primarily out of fear? Some of the recent remarkable pieces on like white fragility and privilege really do ask this question, which is an excellent start. But as Robert Reich reminds us, we are also being fed false narratives again that have historically just thrown us right off track. So we have to be careful. We have to question that. Okay. So I suspect that how we choose to understand, confront, and express our fears individually, collectively, our searching and fearless inventory, will determine in large part who we are as a people and community. So I just want you to think about that. I appreciate you listening to me today. I do want to leave you with one final thought. I talked about my little theory that decisions based on fear don't turn out well. The second reading we had, Loving in Fear, exhorts us to think a different way. So it's sort of the flip side of that theory. That those decisions that we make primarily out of healthy caring, affection, or love are far more likely to lead to growth and joy. So when we reach out without fear to another human, when we stand on the side of love, as our faith has been working on. We reject fear as an obstruction and offer ourselves an opportunity for joy. And remember that the birds of worry or care fly above your head, this you cannot change, but that they build nests in your hair, this you can prevent. Thank you.